From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest is Jane Bullock, former chief of staff of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. In the wake of the dubious response of local and federal governments to the hurricanes this year, we'll be discussing what measures the federal government can take to prepare for disasters and mitigate their impacts on affected areas. And we'll take a critical look at how the Bush administration has changed the structure of disaster response since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. A study released by the Government Accountability Office last week reported that reimportation of drugs from abroad is substantial and increasing. The report estimates that the number of packages received through the U.S. Postal Service each year is on the order of 10 million, about half of which come from Canada, and the other half from a large number of other countries. The report noted that large numbers of internet companies are entering the drug reimportation business, leading to a virtual black market of bootleg pharmaceuticals. The purity and quality of these medications is unknown. The U.S. Customs Service formed a task force last year to study the issue, but little progress has been made thus far to prevent Americans from engaging in reimportation of prescriptions. It seems likely that as long as prescription drugs cost 50% more in the United States than in any other developed country, the government will make few inroads into preventing Americans from seeking drugs abroad. The website of the Government Accountability Office is gao.gov. The major act of Congress that was supposed to effectively bring down prescription drug prices was the Medicare Reform Act, passed in November 2003. The act is set to go into effect in January, and enrollment starts this month. Unfortunately, despite having had 2 years to get beneficiaries of Medicare to understand the program, it appears that confusion is only increasing. Around the country, Medicare enrollees are flocking to workshops where experts present them with complicated descriptions of drug formularies, tiered copayments, creditable coverage, and true out-of-pocket costs, and caution about penalties for late enrollment. But even though President Bush described the plan on November 5th as the greatest advance in health care for seniors in 40 years, large numbers of older Americans appear to be overwhelmed and confused by the choices they'll have to make. Commenting for the New York Times on the widespread reports of dissatisfaction and confusion, Michael Levitt, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, pointed out that lots of things in life are complicated: filling out a tax form, registering your car, or getting cable TV. But the Times article quotes William Beard, a retired chemist in Wichita, Kansas, who takes 8 prescription drugs, including several heart medicines. He notes that despite having a PhD-level education, the program's too complicated for him, and he questioned how the majority of beneficiaries will handle it. A national survey conducted in late October by researchers at Harvard School of Public Health found that more than 6 in 10 seniors indicated they don't understand the drug program, most thought it would not help them personally, and 43% still haven't decided if they'll enroll. While among those who have made a decision, By a nearly 2-to-1 margin, most seniors indicated they don't plan to enroll in the program. The Medicare article appears in the November 13th edition of the New York Times, nytimes.com, and the Harvard survey is available through the Harvard School of Public Health website, hsph.harvard.edu. Coming up next, an interview with Jane Bullock on disaster preparedness in the United States. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. For the last 2 years, an unusually large number of disasters have occurred both worldwide and within the United States. On last month's show, we looked at the role of human activity, such as patterns of settlement, deforestation, and especially global warming, in aggravating or even causing disasters such as floods, droughts, and hurricanes. On today's show, we'll continue our focus on disasters by looking at the organization of the public and private sector response to disasters in the United States. We may never know why President Bush appointed Michael Brown as the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, otherwise known as FEMA. Brown had no experience whatever in the field of disaster and emergency response. He had spent the previous 12 years as a mid-level functionary at the International Arabian Horse Association. Many highly skilled, experienced FEMA employees departed the agency during the period of Brown's tenure, including our guest on today's show. Clearly, there was a steep price to be paid for the loss of so much expertise and talent at FEMA, especially in New Orleans. But the inept response to Hurricane Katrina has led many people to wonder how a more functional and competent FEMA might have responded to such a massive disaster. On today's show, we'll address this question, and we'll discuss the process of evacuating threatened areas, and how to achieve access to medical care, housing, and safe water during disasters. And we'll also look at the difficult problem of environmental contamination, which so frequently complicates many types of disasters. Joining us to discuss these issues today is Jane Bullock. Jane Bullock's distinguished career includes 22 years working at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, the lead agency in the federal government that organizes the response to disasters. She worked there from 1980 through 2002, and during her final 7 years there, she served as its chief of staff. During her years at FEMA, notable achievements include improving coordination between local government and FEMA, focusing on assuring that practice runs and disaster preparedness exercises occur, including her organization of the first major federal exercise of emergency management response to a terrorist event. She was also instrumental in improving planning and prevention of damage from flooding. Currently, Jane Bullock serves on the faculty of George Washington University and is a partner in Bullock and Haddo, a firm that provides consultation services in disaster management and mitigation. Jane Bullock, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good morning, Marvin.
In planning for a disaster, I'd like to start out about the decision to evacuate. Now, that type of decision is one of the most extreme ones you can take, and obviously in many types of disasters, such as 9/11,
there was not a need to evacuate a very large area. On the other hand, in the setting of hurricanes that are coming and you're not exactly sure where, that decision can affect a large population. So from your experiences working in emergency and disaster preparedness, how is that decision made?
Well, first of all, the decision to evacuate is a decision that's made by a local government official, a mayor, a county superintendent, or a state government official. The federal government does not have the authority to order an evacuation. In the context of making the order, in most cases where we are looking at evacuations, such as hurricanes or a slow-moving flood or a hazardous materials incident, normally the organization who is going to be responsible for that evacuation, state or local government, has planned the evacuation. They've taken the time to look at how many people would have to evacuate, exactly how the roads would need to be used, to look at countermeasures in terms of changing the lanes and roads. And usually it's been exercised. And that's the important part. There, in planning an evacuation, you can never have it be perfect, but there are a lot of things that you can anticipate. You usually know how many people you're talking about. There's been major evacuations that have gone well. There's also, as we saw in Katrina and then again in Rita, Hurricane Rita, there are evacuations that don't go so well. In 1999, we evacuated, when I was still at FEMA, approximately 2.6 million people as Hurricane Floyd was looking to impact Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And that evacuation had been planned and exercised several times, and it went fairly smoothly.
When you compare the evacuation for Hurricane Floyd in Florida with the two evacuations more recently, let's talk about the evacuation of Floyd. Why did that one go better? What were the features of that that made it go well?
Well, I think, first of all, is the fact that it had been exercised, and it had been planned with the state officials, the local officials, the police, the fire, the transportation planners, the people that would be responsible for changing the road lanes, for changing the lights. And it also came after we had had several other hurricanes, such as Hurricane Fran, that where we had evacuated and the evacuations had not gone as smoothly. With Floyd, we had a very major effort among the states that could be impacted to come up with a plan that would work. It wasn't totally smooth. There were still some glitches in terms of people running out of gas on the roads. And also, we were not dealing with as many special population needs as you saw in Hurricane Katrina. By that, I mean, we knew there would be a certain level of population that would not have the availability of their own private automobile, so we had to anticipate using buses and pre-staging buses. But it was much more of an urban, suburban population than what we saw in Katrina. In Katrina, the planning for an evacuation of New Orleans always recognized that about 20% of the population in the city of New Orleans probably did not have their own personal transportation. So they would have to look towards the use of other forms of transportation, bus convoys, possibly the train system that was still operational, and things of that sort.
So then why did Katrina go so poorly? Was one factor that it was not begun early enough? Was that part of the problem?
I think that was a factor. The governor and the mayor had talked about evacuation. But in the context of Katrina, both the governor and Mayor Nagin of New Orleans had not had any experience in disasters. They were very new to their positions. And in the context of that evacuation, once there was a federal involvement, which occurred on Saturday, what normally would have happened is the director of FEMA would have been talking with the mayor and talking with the governor as early as Saturday, if not earlier, and suggesting that they begin the mandatory evacuation on Saturday. Instead, the mayor waited until Sunday to make it mandatory, and as the storm was coming, they also didn't get the resources that the federal government could have brought to bear to help that evacuation. And by this, I mean military assets that could have been brought in, boats that some of the Navy Zodiac boats that could have taken people out once the water started getting high, more helicopter support than the Coast Guard, which was the only support they had, and also convoys of buses and other trucks, as well as the fact that there was still a train system on the west side of the city that was operational and was not used.
For listeners who may not remember, you're referring to Saturday and Sunday. That's the Saturday was the 27th, and by the morning of Saturday the 27th, they pretty much had pegged down that the hurricane would strike 2 days later on the morning of Monday, August 29th.
Right.
So basically they lost half the full day, which was about half the time they had left. Is that the idea?
That's about it. Yes. Yeah.
So, again, is it possible for a city with such a large population of people who don't have automobiles to actually evacuate? Can that actually be realistically done?
It can be realistically done, but of course we do recognize that there is always a certain percentage of the population that will not evacuate. People that are reluctant to leave their homes or their businesses for fear of what's going to happen in the aftermath. People who physically cannot do, so you do have to always have shelters in the area that's going to be impacted, and in this context, it was the Superdome as the shelter of last resort. But evacuations have to have the cooperation of the people. It also has to have the trust of the people, and the people have to be involved in planning it so they understand. Just a little sideline. In Washington, D.C., whenever there's a snowstorm and the federal government has to close down, it used to just be totally chaotic. And then in the middle 90s, the Clinton administration decided that they would work with the employees of the federal government to ask them how they would feel or how they would react to a close down of the federal government. And in working with the employees, they came up with a system that worked by zip codes. And subsequent to that, whenever there was a close down of the federal government, people got out of the city much more easily. It's very, very important that people be involved in the planning of things that are going to affect them, such as an evacuation.
The next major hurricane after Hurricane Katrina that required a major evacuation was Hurricane Rita, which was about just under 4 weeks later. And there was somewhat more notice, but with Hurricane Rita, there was in some ways a bigger problem that it appeared that the hurricane might strike Houston. And of course, Houston is the fourth largest metro area in the country. So the challenge was going to be much greater. On the other hand, we had just had the experience of a fairly poorly run evacuation of New Orleans, so one would have thought that would have been a big advantage and that the officials would have done much better. But again, in the evacuation of Houston, people tried to comply in that case, but it really didn't seem to go very well. And there was stop-and-go traffic. People were running out of gas on the interstate. And I guess, what's your evaluation of that evacuation? Do you feel that one was mishandled? Or is it really not possible to effectively evacuate such a large city?
Well, I think that the evacuation for Hurricane Rita in the Houston area definitely went better because they started the evacuation sooner. But once again, there wasn't the opportunity or there has not been the attention on the local officials and state officials to really be thinking about these evacuations. Rita was better in that they called for a mandatory evacuation with more time to get people out of the city. They had some of the same logistical problems. I was surprised that they did not pre-position gasoline trucks, tankers of gasoline, so that if people ran out of gas, there was a way to get gas on the medians. I was surprised that they did not change more of the lanes to take people out of the city. The other problem was some people who did not wait for their evacuation. People spontaneously evacuated, and a lot of the people were not aware of the routes. And once again, you've got a situation where the public is being impacted, the public is not involved in the decision-making process, and the public hasn't been educated as to this is what's going to happen. Their concerns aren't built into the event and the evacuation, and that's very, very important. We really need to learn from the Katrina evacuation and the Rita evacuation that these processes are going to be needed in the future because we are going to have other hurricanes, and we really need to sit down and talk with the people and find out what is the decision-making process for them and how it can be more effectively take into effect their concerns and go more smoothly.
The media coverage of the aspects of the evacuation of Houston that didn't seem to go well seemed to focus on the slow or not moving, the non-moving traffic on the interstates and the difficulties faced by people who were actually attempting to drive out of the area. But because there really was not a major disaster that ultimately occurred in Houston, since Hurricane Rita ended up landing a good deal further north, we didn't really find out about whether the poorer people who didn't own cars actually got out. Do you happen to know that?
No, I don't. I have not heard as much about what happened in the center of Houston. I do know they had buses that were taking people out because we, of course, know of the unfortunate bus accident. And they had made more accommodation to people with special needs because they did evacuate some of the hospitals and some of the nursing homes and senior care facilities. Evacuations are an enormous logistical nightmare, and you need to have all sorts of different resources at your ready. And that's why in the case of Hurricane Katrina, when President Bush signed the disaster declaration that Saturday, the 27th of August, that meant that federal resources would be made available to help the city and the state. And I think that if, in fact, federal resources had been brought to bear, we wouldn't have seen some of the problems that we saw relative to people who had been left in the city.
That raises a question of experience and competence. Hurricanes can land anywhere over thousands of miles of U.S. coastline. This is a large area, and chances are that any given area may not, within the previous 10 years, have had experience. On the other hand, the federal officials presumably would be involved in every single one and would have more useful experience to offer. And I guess the question I have is there a mechanism in place, at least that's worked in the past or that could be implemented, where the expertise of the federal level and having been involved in every disaster would come to bear and help out the local officials?
Well, Marvin, first of all, hurricanes are possible all up and down the East Coast, as far north as Maine and actually beyond the U.S. borders into the maritime provinces. And, you know, down from Maine through New York, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, all around the Gulf, the East Coast and around to the Gulf Coast. And during the 1990s, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which I was a part of, had a fairly robust planning for hurricanes. We, in 1993, we asked the states to do a self-assessment as to how they would react if there was a major hurricane impacting their states. And based on those self-assessments, and the states were very honest, there were a lot of the states that were unprepared. FEMA started funding very specific evacuation studies, studies of what potential storm surge would occur based on varying category hurricanes and the levels of population. And we began to do some fairly intense planning. Now, also during the 1990s, we had a huge increase in populations moving to coastal areas. So you've got increase in people moving into the harm's way. You've got the federal government working with the states to try and come up with planning and with scenarios and with exercises. And I think at the end of the 1990s, we saw the positive impacts of that. We experienced Hurricane Floyd, where we had a successful evacuation of 2.6 million. We had Hurricane Dennis. We had a series of major hurricanes that didn't go perfectly, but there was a huge improvement in how the state and localities planned for and responded to and recovered from hurricanes. FEMA began an aggressive program of trying to buy out people who were living in low-lying areas that was very successful. And we were progressing. We had a major study underway of a large-scale evacuation all up the East Coast. We had the beginnings of the study that would eventually result in the Hurricane Pam exercise that was the scenario of a Category 5 hitting on New Orleans. But unfortunately, with the change of administration in 2000 and with the events of September 11th in New York, the focus of the federal government changed from dealing with natural disasters to dealing with terrorism. And a lot of the expertise that had been created at the state and local level in planning for events such as hurricanes was dissipated. The funding for hurricane preparedness was almost zeroed out, and state and local governments, in order to get funding for emergency management activities such as this, had to spend at least 75% of their funding on planning for terrorism. And while there are some similarities, there are not as many terrorist incidents where you would use evacuation as a mode for dealing with it. So we lost a lot of good talent and a lot of time and energy that had been spent on dealing with natural disasters when the focus became one of terrorism.
I have one last question about evacuations, and that is, in the United States, most of the cities in the whole country, particularly the South and the Western U.S., have minimal public transportation systems. They may have buses that compete with cars on the roadways, but they don't have subway systems as some of the older cities, particularly Chicago and especially New York City. And one obvious disadvantage of having a very good subway system is that in New York City, a much smaller percentage of the population owns automobiles compared to the cities in the southern and western U.S. that don't have public transportation. So I'm wondering, is it an advantage to have public transportation in terms of evacuating the population, or is it a problem that people don't have automobiles? How do you view that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things that FEMA was concerned about in the 90s was if, in fact, we had a major hurricane impacting New York City and we were looking to evacuation, would that hurricane and the storm surge flood the subway? So it's something you have to be aware of. I mean, there's a positive and a negative. The whole issue of evacuation in large metropolitan areas in the advent of Hurricane Katrina, I think, needs to be relooked. Because it is a different type of population. It is a different, there's more serious special needs people that have to be recognized, and their needs have to be considered, and they need to be part of the planning process. I think that public transportation is an advantage, but there are other alternatives. There are alternatives to bringing in buses. There's alternatives to areas that have already begun flooding, that there are federal assets that can be brought in that can deal with, you know, 3 feet of standing water, 10 feet of standing water even. I simply think that Katrina and Rita and the fact that this has been the most severe hurricane season of the last decade is going to have the governments at all levels reevaluate what their priorities are relative to preparedness for hazards. We need to find a balance between the fact that everyone recognizes that there could be another terrorist attack, or even more likely a bioterrorism attack, or dealing with avian or pandemic flu anywhere in the United States. We need to recognize that, but we also need to recognize that because of certain conditions, the oceans are getting warmer, we're having more and more severe large hurricanes, and we probably are going to see that for the next few years. So we need to achieve a better balance of dealing with all of the hazards people face, and most importantly, including the people who are facing these hazards in the dialogue as to how we deal with preparing and responding to them.
The housing of New Orleans evacuees also became an issue, and it, in fact, still is months later. Is there an approach that the Federal Emergency Management Agency and also the locals, is there a standard plan for transitioning people from emergency housing to long-term housing? How does that work?
the issue of housing people has become a larger and larger issue once again, as we've seen hurricanes impacting larger numbers of population because of the population increase in coastal areas. The traditional way that FEMA had handled temporary housing in disasters during the 90s and even prior to the 90s was first to utilize any existing temporary housing, and that's apartments or hotels or motels that are still in the area that was impacted and are livable after the storm has gone through. The second form of housing was the use of travel trailers and mobile homes, which in the 90s the federal government actually used to stockpile, but now the federal government basically purchases on need. The problem with mobile homes is, in order to be efficient in making it as a form of temporary housing, you have to create kind of mobile home parks. And they're not, a lot of communities do not like the appearance of a mobile home park in their community. There are problems with mobile home parks once they've been established, as we can see happening in Florida from last year's storms, in that there's often security problems. They're not owned. There's no ownership by local governments, so the services are not usually as good. And in the case of the mobile home park, one of them that was set up last year in Punta Gorda, Florida, we've noticed that there's a large increase in suicide rates among people who are in the mobile homes. So mobile home parks are something we use. They're not necessarily one of the best alternatives. If, in fact, you're in an area where you can bring in what we call pop-up trailers, and the trailers can be set on individual homeowners' lands, like next to their single-family home, that's a preferred option because then the homeowner is close to their home while it's being repaired, and it's a much smaller operation. It doesn't require setting up a infrastructure. They can more or less be plugged in. But in major metropolitan areas, neither one of those are good alternatives because there usually isn't, you know, people live in apartment buildings or multi-story buildings and townhouses, so there's not a whole lot of land, and in most cases there's not a footprint for large empty spaces to put up mobile home parks. So with Katrina and to a degree with the Florida hurricanes last year, the federal government is frankly scrambling to come up with alternatives. The other thing that really needs to be recognized, the federal government only provides temporary housing for 18 months. So at the end of 18 months, if your home or has not been rebuilt or if you have not found alternative housing in terms of moved into a new apartment or something of that sort, you are basically asked to leave the federal housing. And we're beginning to see that in Florida. And I think when we look at the situation in New Orleans, we really have to recognize that in Louisiana and parts of Mississippi, we may be dealing with a large number of displaced persons that may never return to the area, or if they do return, may become part of a homeless population.
So what is your solution, and what's your proposal to deal with the potential rise in the number of homeless?
I don't have a solution. I know that there are people that are part of the Louisiana Recovery Committee, and I know that Mayor Nagin has a committee working on this issue, that people are talking about it. They're talking about how you can rebuild New Orleans and other areas of Louisiana and Mississippi with affordable housing, because that is going to be a large issue. I also believe that many of the people, or a certain proportion of the people that were evacuated, may never return. They may find jobs where they are. They may find that their children are in school and they like where they are. So I think we will see some population shifts. What Katrina appears to have done is shown, highlighted, and maybe brought to everyone across the nation's attention some of the problems that had pre-existed in New Orleans relative to public health and safety, relative to a large poverty, below poverty income population that was maybe getting along, but once the infrastructure and their homes and housing has been taken away, it's a problem that has to be solved. And I do know that officials at all levels, but specifically at the state and local level, are looking at this, and there, it's a very tough problem to solve.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we're looking at how government and private sector agencies organize and respond to major disasters, and the central role that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, plays in the response to disasters. And our guest is Jane Bullock, who worked at FEMA for over two decades, for much of that time as chief of staff. After the break, we'll be discussing the public health response to disasters, including the provision of medical services, the assurance of safe drinking water, and the common problem of environmental contamination in many disasters, including Hurricane Katrina. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, our guest is Jane Bullock, who has devoted her career to disaster preparedness and disaster response, and worked for the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency for 22 years, seven of those as chief of staff. I began the second part of today's discussion by asking Ms. Bullock how FEMA approaches the delivery of medical care services during major disasters, when hospitals and most other healthcare facilities may become non-operational. Now back to the interview.
Now, disasters pose numerous direct challenges to what we would more conventionally call public health. Maybe we could review some of those and talk about how disaster planners might address them. First of all, in disasters, people are obviously prone to injuries. For example, in a flood, people may be wading through water that could have sharp objects submerged, and then obviously in tornadoes and hurricanes, there's high winds blowing around objects that can cause injury. So you'd expect many injuries to occur in these situations, and obviously also when an earthquake strikes. So speaking from the point of view of someone who practices medicine, I can tell you that there is a real effort in hospitals across this country, in most countries now, to really not have extra beds, not have extra capacity, to have it so that all our expenses are direct, all the labor, especially the labor costs in healthcare and hospitals in particular, are only what's needed. We back off staff if the intensive care unit is less occupied. So I guess the question I'm getting at is, I don't know how much extra capacity we have in our hospital or in any other hospital that I've ever worked in. Usually we try to just have enough beds open for what our community needs, you know, and maybe in January when there may be some more admissions than the rest of the year. But in a disaster, there could be many, many more. And what is the planning process that helps to address that?
I would say that I agree with you that the state of our public health discipline and facilities has certainly deteriorated, and it's an issue that needs to be looked at, especially when we're looking at high, like an earthquake. You know, there's a scenario that if there should be an earthquake along the New Madrid Fault, which runs up through the Midwest from Missouri up to as far as Chicago and down to Arkansas and that area, that there could be, you know, as many as 200,000 people injured. And there's not the capacity in the public health or even in the private health system to handle those kinds of injuries. What happens in most disasters is when, once again, when the local or state capacity is exhausted, the federal government comes in, and that's FEMA and all of the other agencies of the federal government if the president declares the disaster. And in that context, there are systems for DMAT teams, which are disaster military assistance teams made up of private doctors that come in that have training in dealing with emergencies. There are DMORTS teams, which are the disaster mortuary teams. There's the capacity to set up field hospitals through using some of the military assets. This is going to become an ever more pressing issue when we talk about the potential for bioterrorist events, the potential for a pandemic flu or an avian flu issue. And I don't know how rigorous the planning is. The planning that I participated in when I was at FEMA really focused more on how we would handle major medical problems in a large earthquake. One of the things, though, that happened in Katrina that I think was very, very disturbing is because federal assets were lacking, generators that hospitals counted on to keep their hospitals going, and most of the hospitals had generators that were going to last X amount of time, 3 or 4 days, and then they ran out of fuel. Well, at that point, one of the things that in the past FEMA always did in the aftermath of a disaster was bring in these huge generator packs and fuel for generators. And we took them to hospitals, other critical facilities, police stations, fire stations, et cetera, to make sure that those critical facilities could keep functioning. I don't know why those assets weren't made available in Katrina, except the federal government just didn't seem to pull the trigger on their assets. But Katrina, once again, has highlighted the need to relook how we handle the aftermath of a major disaster from a public health standpoint.
So what you're saying is that you don't think that the issue of hospitals being able to expand their capacity, I guess that's called surge capacity,
mm-hmm.
You're saying that you don't think that's actually been worked out, because that could come up for terrorist types of incidents as well, I would think.
Yes, I agree. I think there has been some efforts through the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and through the Department of Health and Home and Human Services, HHS, but I don't think that it's comprehensive. And I'm not sure that they're looking at the issues that need to be looked at. I think there had been some planning done at the federal level should there be a large earthquake as to what would happen. Also, the president has created something called the Medical Corps. I don't know how they're going to fit into whatever the new plan is for dealing with this. But it's a very, very large issue. And especially when you're looking at the aftermath of something like this hurricane, where you're dealing with buildings that have to be inspected and the potential for all sorts of airborne problems from asbestos and other things.
Another health problem that arises in floods and in earthquakes and many other types of disasters, a cutoff of the usual water supply, either because pipes are destroyed in an earthquake or the system is backed up in a flood or the power to water purification systems might be out. And, of course, drinking contaminated water can lead to a large variety of viral and bacterial illnesses affecting the intestines. So how is that handled?
Well, I would say that one of the first things that happens in the aftermath of any sort of disaster is that logistics of bringing in water, potable water, is the number one, if not the number one, it's one of the top three. Water and ice are the two consumables that are usually pre-positioned before a disaster so that they're made available immediately after the storm leaves, or even while the storm is still occurring or the flood is still occurring, so it's made available. Once again, the pre-positioning of water and ice did not occur in Katrina, and we saw the problems that resulted afterwards. But that's something that, once again, it's kind of a no-brainer. We know that you're going to need potable water, you're going to need ice, and there should have been pre-positioning of those assets before Katrina hit, both in Mississippi and in Louisiana, and actually to a lesser degree Alabama. And then after Katrina hit, we heard the stories of, you know, ice trucks getting diverted to all sorts of different places. I think the Katrina identified a breakdown in the normal system of disaster response in this country, and it needs to be fixed, and it's not going to be fixed with the current structure that exists.
What do you mean by current structure?
Well, the reason that we went through the series of disasters in the 1990s and we developed probably, I think, what was considered the model response agency in the Federal Emergency Management Agency was because we focused on all hazards. We focused on the customers being those people impacted by any sort of hazard. And we worked with our state and local partners, and we allowed localities and we allowed states to plan for the risk that was most prominent, earthquake, tornado, hurricane, hazardous materials, but to look at all hazards. And we worked together with them to plan, prepare, respond, and also mitigate. We put a heavy emphasis on mitigation and also on talking and working with the public so that they would understand what was going to happen before, after, and during an incident. And FEMA was an independent agency. It had the authority to task every other federal agency in the aftermath of a disaster, and even before, to pre-deploy resources. It had a director who knew how to make decisions and what needed to be done in a disaster, and that director, James Lee Witt, had the full support of the president, President Clinton. President Clinton and his administration understood that when there was a disaster, the people of the United States expected their government to be there for them. And FEMA was there. And we pre-positioned resources such as water and ice. We worked with local governments to do evacuation planning so we could successfully evacuate from Hurricane Floyd. And most importantly, we worked with communities to move people out of harm's way before the event struck. You know, disasters, unfortunately, tend to disproportionately impact the poor because they normally live in areas, low-lying areas where the land is not quite as good, such as along the Midwest floods and along the Mississippi floods in 93, where thousands of communities were flooded. We bought out hundreds of thousands of homes and moved people to higher ground. So when that flood was repeated in 1995, those people were not impacted. So there wasn't an economic loss. There wasn't a social loss. But the difference in the 1990s was you had an administration that cared about people, that recognized that it was a responsibility of not just state and local, but the federal government to be there during times of disasters. And we worked very closely with people. That ended when the Bush administration came in, because the Bush administration put a high premium on local and state being self-prepared, it being a public health and safety being a local and state issue, and the focus became terrorism. And FEMA was no longer an independent agency. It was moved into the Department of Homeland Security, and within the Department of Homeland Security, its mission is incompatible. The mission of the Department of Homeland Security is to prevent future terrorism attacks by protecting our borders, protecting our skies, and protecting our seas. The mission of FEMA is to deal with the consequences of any disaster, be it natural or terrorist. And as a consequence, it's to work with people that are impacted by that disaster and to reduce the impact through preparedness, through response, recovery, and mitigation. And FEMA Director Michael Brown couldn't pick up the phone and call Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld and say, we need help. We need military assets down here. He had to go through Chertoff. Chertoff had to go through the president. And as a result of that, those resources weren't there. And in Katrina, people died. People didn't have to die.
Both terrorists and natural disasters can also create environmental hazards. For example, a dirty bomb would create the threat of radioactivity, and Hurricane Katrina left toxic sludge throughout the houses and streets of New Orleans, especially noted after the floodwater was drained from the city. Is environmental analysis part of the disaster response planning?
Yes. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is a partner with the other federal agencies in disaster response. It's very critical for people to go in and do environmental monitoring. It's critical for people to do once the water recedes, when we begin to bring wastewater treatment facilities and public water facilities back online to make sure that they're operating properly, to go in and inspect houses. I mean, it's a huge issue to go in and inspect a house that's had water damage or any other damage, especially elderly homes where there might be asbestos, where mold is growing, and then to encapsulate the mold or get rid of the mold. And you're right, the Katrina is a good example of a huge environmental response. And in virtually every disaster, there's an environmental context, and that's why the Environmental Protection Agency is part of the Federal Response Plan, which is now called the National Response Plan, because it's a recognition that it's a very critical function. If you were to drive around New Orleans now, you see certain houses that are marked with different colors. I mean, some of them have red X's on it, which means that a search and rescue team has been there. Some of them have other markings, which means that an environmental team has been in and examined it. And then some have markings from actual housing inspectors that are looking at the structural integrity of the house or the facility. So that is ongoing in Katrina and Rita and in Mississippi and Alabama, but it's a huge issue.
Well, I would think it would be enormous. The Environmental Protection Agency already has a list of Superfund sites that it's not getting to for years and years and years, and to add an entire city or even larger than New Orleans would just seem to be overwhelming. Is that really likely to get properly addressed?
Well, first of all, EPA uses not just their own resources, they use private sector resources. They contract with firms that have specialties in this area to do it. But it's a huge issue, and I think those of people in New York in the post 9/11, there was a lot of concern that the EPA said that it was safe to go back into certain areas, and people have concerns that perhaps EPA allowed people back into those areas too soon. I would hope that EPA and their contractors err on the side of caution when it comes to the impacts in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, because there just were so much problems. Some places there was 3 to 4 feet of water for 2 weeks, and it was brackish water, it was black water. So I think they need to be very, very careful and err on the side of caution as to when people are let back in. Of course, on the other hand, people are always very anxious to go back into their homes or their workplaces, or business owners, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a balance. It's a tough balance.
I'd like to ask you about the spin that happened after Hurricane Katrina. And let me set the stage for you and you can respond. A number of people who were trying to defend the Bush administration took the position that the federal government didn't have a lot of time, that Katrina was a massive disaster, and that there would have been no way to do much better. It was just too big and too massive. On the other hand, other people took the exact opposite point of view, that there might have been a way to respond to the disaster, but government always does a bad job, and we should just cut government funding, potentially even cut the funding to FEMA, and instead just give money to the private sector and to faith-based groups, and they'll do a better job. What do you see as the appropriate relationship between the various types of private sector organizations, and can they simply replace government in responding to disasters?
Well, I feel very, very strongly that they cannot replace government in responding to disasters. I think they are absolutely critical partners with government. But fundamentally, public health and safety is a constitutional requirement for state and local governments, and when state and local governments' ability to maintain public health and safety is exhausted, we do need to look to the federal government. The need for the federal government to be involved is that FEMA, when it was an independent statutory agency throughout from 79, when it was created by Jimmy Carter, till the end of the 1990s, it built a system that allowed for state and local governments to work in concert with the federal government and private sector agencies. You mentioned the Red Cross. The Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the Mennonites. There are very many private sector groups that are necessary as partners during a disaster and in the aftermath of a disaster to set up shelters, to do food kitchens, to do crisis counseling with people, to provide clothing, provide individual needs that are not covered by what's offered through federal government or state and local government. But the capacity of the federal government eclipses what you have in the private sector. Katrina was a disaster that didn't need to happen, and the government had fallen apart. There was no focus at the federal level. There was no leadership at the federal level to get those assets that the federal government, and only the federal government, has in to help the people of New Orleans. And unfortunately, Marvin, you're still seeing it. 2 months after this storm has hit, the recovery is moving just so slowly. And to think that the Red Cross or the faith-based organizations could do this by themselves is ludicrous. You need a strong leadership and a strong coordinating arm, such as FEMA used to be, to actually get this done. And you need help from the military, and the military can set up food kitchens. The military can help with evacuations. The military, especially in the context of the Corps of Engineers, are prime arms of the disaster response. The Corps of Engineers does most of the debris cleanup after a disaster. And the Corps uses private contractors to accomplish a lot of that. But to think that these disasters should be turned over to non-governmental agencies, it just won't work. I mean, I don't know if people realize FEMA actually reimburses the American Red Cross for setting up shelters and running shelters for us. We recognize that we need them. We recognize that we need the Mennonites. There's an organization called NOVAD. It's the National Voluntary Organizations Active in Disasters. And that's an organization of, you know, over 200 plus members of nonprofit and private organizations that help out in disasters. And we need those. You need all those resources. But to think that it could be done by the private sector, I just don't think it's going to work. It certainly needs to be done better by the government sector. And that will only be accomplished if this administration makes a commitment to rebuilding the response structure that existed in the United States.
Jane Bullock, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here, Marvin. Thank you for taking the time to address this very important issue.
I'd encourage listeners who'd like to learn more about disaster response to check out the website of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the government agency that has primary responsibility for responding to major disasters. The web address is FEMA.gov. The website of the Red Cross is redcross.org, and the Centers for Disease Control has an especially good description of the public health aspects of major disasters. CDC's web address is cdc.gov. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.